Anything combat with Johnny K.
It's anything combat, though.
Welcome back, combatants, to the Anything Combat Show. I'm your host, Johnny K, and today we're joined by Nassirdin Imavov, who's the number 4 UFC middleweight in the world right now. He's head coach. He's a BJJ and Lucha Libre black belt. Please welcome to the show, Nicholas Ott. How are you doing, Nicholas?
I'm doing well. Very nice to be in this show.
All good, brother. Can you please tell me when you first met Nassirdin and how long have you been working with him?
Yeah, you know, Nassirdin Imavov, when he came to Paris, he was living in the south of France. And when he came to Paris, I was already a trainer at the MMA factory. So when he and his brother came to Paris, his brother was much more experienced than Nassirdin Imavov. I think his brother was 9-1. And Nassirdin was only like 1-1. He had only 2 pro fights at the time. So his brother was much more famous, but there was this rumor inside the gym, like there's 2 brothers coming from the SAS. They are very good. You must see them. And so one Friday night, I'm doing the training class, and it's a mixed training class. It's amateur and pro. And there is Thierry Soukoudjou at the training class. Maybe you know him. He was fighting in Pride back in the days. He did fought in Strikeforce in the UFC, like huge name in the combat sport. Thierry Soukoudjou, and he was at the class, and Nassirdin was there too. So I put them together, Nassirdin and Thierry Soukoudjou, and Nassirdin was so good against Soukoudjou. I was like, who's this young guy that can outclass an experienced fighter as Thierry Soukoudjou? So I was from the beginning. I was into the train of Nassirdin and his brother.
So you were working at the MMA factory with Fernand Lopez at the time. Can you just run me through your time there? How much did you learn and how much did you progress as a coach there?
Oh, enormously. So what happened is, I did graduate from master's degree in sports science. It was in 2011, did my last year in the UT, UT University of Texas at Austin. Then came back to France and I started working. You know, there's several like trainer diploma in France. So I started doing the trainer diploma. I started to train like personal training and strength and conditioning because that was my diploma that I was in. And at the same time, I was still competing. So I was competing in the French scene, in the grappling scene, got like 2nd. At a grappling national championship, then started to train to do MMA. I was already doing some pancrates. That's what we call it in France. It's like MMA without striking on the ground because MMA was illegal at the time. So I was doing that. Then I heard about like the world championship of MMA amateur. So I was like, yeah, I'm willing to go to this thing. So started training for that, went to the MMA factory to train for it. Got the 3rd place in the World Amateur Championship in 2015 in Las Vegas. And then at the time I was already doing some class for the amateurs, for the beginners. And I was already doing some strength and conditioning for like a big center. In France, there is like a big center for all the sports. And I was doing strength and conditioning over there. So Fernand Lopez, who was the creator of the MMA factory, he was like, I like a lot your way of teaching classes. I would like you to come and give some physical preparation class to take care of some of the fighters on the physical preparation side on the MMA factory. I would like you to teach some beginner class. And very quickly from there, it propulsed me to giving like pro class into the MMA factory. And the mat at the time was a crazy mat. They like Francis Ngannou was there, Karl Amoussou, which was one of the top European at the time. He was there, the Lapillus brother, they were there. There were so many famous names. There is a video I found yesterday where Khalil Rountree is on the mat at the MMA factory, Yann Cutelaba, Cédric Doumbé, Cyril Gane, etc. So the mat was huge, and it gave me very quickly the opportunity to train the pro fighter at the MMA factory. So it was, the way it worked is Fernand Lopez was traveling the world with the fighters. So whenever he was not here to train the fighters, There was me or Toto and Pumbu who would replace him to give the class for the pro. So I started doing that like 2015. 2016, I was in the corner of Taylor Lapillus, preparing him for the camp in the UFC, his last fight in the UFC. And then, you know, going to all the promotion in Europe, Bellator, PFL, RS, the Cage Warriors, and, you know, all those promotions. I kept fighting until, I think, 2017. Did one fight in the Cage Warrior, one in Bama, another one in the small promotion in the UK. And then, you know, it was like life was... fighting would take me a lot of time to fight because I needed to train a lot, but I was already training people in physical preparation, strength and conditioning. I was already training people for camps in MMA. I was already doing some personal training. So I had a lot to do. And it was becoming less and less possible to do with both fighting at high level and at the same time training people at high level. So at one point I decided to choose between fighting and training, and I chose the training way.
So, Nicholas, you were at the MMA Factory. I watched your bronze medal at the IMMAF, and I also watched your Cage Warriors fight. Dude, if you're training these high-level fighters and you've built all these skills and you're constantly cultivating, similar to the coaching styles of, I would say, the Hickman brothers are a big example. They're constantly finding new information and then implementing it with their guys. And these guys, you would never know, but the coach is at such a high level at MMA that if they were to fight, they would be exceptional, right? So I want to ask you, is there any chance that we see you take an MMA fight in the future? Like another one?
So the thing is that I'm going to tell you the truth. The fighting side of it, like going into the cage and fighting, I would love to do it. Just this thing, you know, get into the cage and do it. The preparation, the 6 weeks of preparation, the diet, the weight cut, the waiting for... I don't want to go through that. That's too painful for me at this time. I think that's too painful. So the way I take my pleasure is I have all these high-level fighters into my training camps. And whenever I want to spar, I just put the gloves on and I can spar with anybody at any time. I can spar with world champion in ground game, in wrestling, in Muay Thai, in whatever. I can spar with them and learn with them. So, for example, yesterday, Youssef Bouganem, maybe you know him, like legendary Muay Thai fighter, won
he came on the show.
I came on the show, so you know him. Lumpini champion, Roger Mount, like one of the best type boxer ever. And I was training him so yesterday on the ground game and how to get back up and how to defend. And so we did a lot of work together. And at the end of the training, he took me like a private lesson on giving elbow and giving the knees and stuff like that. I love doing that. I love learning from the best and, you know, trying to be like a sponge. And take what they have in order to teach it to other people. So I'm always, like you said, I'm always practicing what I preach in order to progress and in order to go for forward. I don't want to stop doing that. Fighting in itself, it could be possible. But to tell you the truth, it would be a lot of work to get back into real fighting condition. You know, that's what I call real fighting condition. Is I can give good guys, good MMA fighters, high level MMA fighters. I can give them like one round and a half of good sparring. After that, it's becoming more and more difficult. You know, the cardio training at this level is very difficult. So you know. If you want to do things well, you want to stay focused on what you do.
What's interesting, coach, is out of all the middleweight contenders, back to Nassourdine now, out of all the middleweight contenders in the UFC, Ikram Alaskirov got a lot of shine. Roman Kopilov got a lot of shine. Hamzat Chimaev, we know he gets a lot of hype. With Nasruddin, with the skills that he has, the fact that he can clinch, the fact that he has a good defense jits game, he has good offensive wrestling. We saw that in the Joaquin Buckley and the Chris Curtis fight when he was shooting the takedowns. Personally, I like it when Nasruddin shoots more takedowns because he's got the striking game. He's got pull counters. He's quick. He's a sniper rifle, right? He's got a good kicking game, elbows, knees, and really good boxing. So I feel like Nasruddin has been written off as a contender after the Sean Strickland fight. And now that he's picked up pace, you know, beating Dolidze, you know, beating surging Brendan Allen and beating all these guys. And now that he has that win over Joaquin and what we've seen with Joaquin, what he's done, I feel like Nasruddin has picked up really good pace. And I think this puts him in a really good position to fight a top contender and then fight maybe for the belt. If he wins that fight against a top contender, that will put him at 2 or 1 in the division. That's an instant title shot. That's a really good position to be in. So I want to ask you, with all those skills, the thing that I saw that I was a little bit worried about was in the Brendan Allen fight, the first round, Brendan had taken him down and held him, controlled him. And personally, I didn't think that was going to happen. And then in the second and third, Nasruddin took it, and then he won the fight. So let me just ask you about that. Run me through that fight, and also run me through what you think Nasruddin's doing right now in the division.
Oh, so first of all, if you talk about Brendan Allen, this guy was talking about how the way he was going to fight standing up with Nasruddin Imavov, the way he never took he never was the first to take down, and et cetera, et cetera. And so that was pretty smart. He came to the fight, bring fire to Nasruddin. As soon as the fire came back, got a body lock, upper body lock, which is most of the time he never go for the body lock. He is always going for a double head outside in order to take the back. So he went for a body lock and he surprised Nasruddin Imavov, got him to the ground. Then what most of the people didn't see, Nasruddin could have get up easily. It wasn't the fact that to get up, it was the fact that in order to get up, he had to go to the end on the ground. He had to go to the turtle position, which is the favorite position for Brendan Allen to finish his opponent. So instead of giving his back in order to get up, we decided not to give the back any time in the fight and to recompose the guard in order to not to give the back and stand back up without giving the back. So it was very smart on Brendan Allen's side to block the fight on the ground, cross-face Nasruddin Imavov in order for Nasruddin to have the head turn only on the way to escape by giving his back, and then wait for Nasruddin to make a mistake to be in the hurry of giving his back, or getting back up and try to submit him at the beginning of the fight when there is no sweat and it's not slippery yet. So that was the goal for Brendan Allen. We knew it was his goal. So the goal was to keep our back on the ground. You have no risk when your back is on the ground. Recompose the guard and then get back up from the guard. So that was a good job from Brendan. That was a very good job from Nasruddin to respect the game plan and be enough confident to lose a round to win two others after. You need a lot of confidence. You need a very good training camp in order to still trust your coach and your training camp when there is high tension and high risk in front of your audience in France and everybody's screaming and you just have to turn to stand back up. But it's a very risky position. So that's what happened. Regarding the skills of Nasruddin and the way his hype went, I think Nasruddin Imavov is going to have a career where the more time will pass, the more people will realize his past performance. So if you take, for example, Roman Dolidze and Joaquin Buckley, Joaquin Buckley is like on a 5-win streak. Is killing the 77 kilograms division right now. Roman Dolidze, after Nasruddin Imavov masterpiece against him, like Dolidze did nothing against Nasruddin Imavov. Now he's winning 2 fights in a row, once again, one against Anthony Smith, big name in the division, former belt contender against John Jones. So up one weight class and just beat Kevin Holland. So I think a lot of people gonna like it's like the fight. Sorry, it's like the fight against Sean Strickland. When Nasruddin fought against Strickland, it was only five fights into the UFC. That was his first main event. Strickland was like 12-2 in the UFC, like 14 fights in the UFC. He was already a veteran of the UFC. And Nasruddin went to the decision, won the last round against Strickland. Very tough fight, very close fight. A lot closer than most people realize. And when you watch back the fight, you're like, wow, Nasruddin did great against Sean Strickland. But at the time when the fight happened, you didn't necessarily realize that was a great performance from Nasruddin Imavov. So I think the time will help Nasruddin Imavov grow with his past fight. That's what's going to happen.
What's interesting, Coach, is when I was looking at all the Tapology guys, in my opinion, Nasruddin is still young in the division. Like, he's like 29, 30. You know, we've seen fighters in that division that have stayed there until 35 and still very competitive. You know, Adesanya's going on 36 now, right? So I feel like, and bringing that up with Adesanya, I feel like personally, when you're looking at the matchmaking in the division, seeing that Adesanya has lost the title fight against Dricus, and now he's looking for another contender to get in there, I think purely from a marketing point of view, if the UFC wants to book a really big fight against two high-level strikers, I think they should do the Nasruddin fight with Adesanya. And another thing with that is I feel like if Nasruddin can mix up takedowns against Adesanya, I think he can steal that fight if he does the takedowns. If he doesn't do the takedowns, that's a different story. What do you think?
First of all, regarding the age of Nasruddin, he's 28. So when he came back from Russia, they did a mistake in France. And so in his ID, it's 29, but in reality, it's 28. So first of all, he's very young for the weight class. Second, yeah, Adesanya's great fight for Nasruddin Imavov. We don't know if it's going to happen or not. We wish it's going to happen because it's a big fight. It's an opportunity to show his striking against the best or the second best striker, depending on how you see it, in the whole UFC roster. Because if you say Pereira is the best striker, what do you make of Adesanya who knocked him out and dominated him during five rounds? So you know, second or best striker in the UFC, it would be a great match to see Nasruddin against Israel Adesanya. That's a fight that can go to the ground. That's a fight that can stay standing up. We don't know yet, but great fight. Can't wait to see it.
I want to get back to the Brendan fight. Brendan came on the show as well, and his skills, he's got skills everywhere. He's another guy that's balanced in a lot of different areas. Did you want Brendan to gas in the first round? Was that part of the game plan that you guys came up with?
No. You know what happened in the second and third round? We were looking to do that from the very beginning, like Brendan striking, trying to mix it up, going for the takedown, Nasruddin defending the takedown, then punish him. And I think we would have had like a knockouts or submission in the second or third round if the first one wouldn't have been like that. But, you know, great job from Brendan Allen. Good striking, great fighter, huge like physical fighter, like is as big as Nasruddin. Good guy. I think with the time we'll see how much Brendan Allen is a good fighter, and you'll see him climb up the middleweight division for sure.
With the game planning for that fight and all the game planning that you do with Nasruddin, do you find it more important to have a simple game plan and really focus on the key performance, the most important factors in their game plan? Or do you come up with a complex game plan and just try and get every single factor on dial, you know, try and figure out every single thing about the opponent?
Mm. So first thing first, you have to look at the opponent and what is the strongest point of the opponent. So if you look at Brendan Allen, there's like he was on a series of 7 wins, 5 by submission, 5 by rear naked choke. Then when you say that, you have to see where those chokes happened. How did it come? Like, is it from the ground? Is it like he knocks the guy down, then finish him? You know, there's a multiple reason for the choke to be happening. So you have to look very precisely how it chains things together in order to get the choke. So that's what we did. Then you have to think, okay, he can win by finish, the rear naked choke. If it's not finished, what can he do? Maybe he can block the fight against the cage. Maybe he can... So you have to think of all the possibilities for the fighter to win the fight. Then you have to take off those possibilities. You have to say, like, if he can win this way, this way, this way, this way, this way, how can I counter all of his way of winning? Because if he cannot win, I'm going to win the fight. So first of all, we have to make sure he's not going to win the fight. So we take off the possibilities for him to win the fight. Second, we have to think how we will win the fight. How can we maximize our advantages in order to finish the fight? And then you have to think about that. And then once you have the plan, you have to try the plan and see how it works out. So I have to bring a very good sparring partner that try to that can mimic. I always say I don't want sparring partner to try to imitate someone else because they're going to regress if they try to imitate. So my job is to find the partner that already has the skills to be as good or better than the guy that we're going to go against. So for example, on the wrestling side, we brought like 2 guys, Ahmed Salamov. He was the RS champion of the division. Very good grappler, very good wrestler. And we brought also an Egyptian guy, Mohamed, which is he did 5th at the World Championship in wrestling. And so on the wrestling side, we knew the guys that was wrestling against Nassourdine Mavov, they were better than Brendan Allen. And that's what we're trying to do on every position. So on the wrestling side, we bring better guys. On the striking side, we bring better guys. We brought some guys from Glory Kickboxing. On the ground game, we bring better guys too. And then we do general training and specific training. General training is going to be like MMA sparring, where everything's a lot. Specific training is going to be specific situation where Brendan Allen can shine or where Nassourdine Mavov can shine. And we will try to exploit those situations in order to make the best choice in each situation.
When I look at Imavov's style, I have to say that for a tall guy, his combination punching, the fact that he can flow the punches together in the sequencing from the uppercuts to the hooks, and then when he throws a overhand, he rolls into another punch. For a long person, it is very difficult with long arms to do that because you can get countered, you can't bring it back to your chin as fast, and also you've got slower punches because you've got long arms. The straight's a different story, but when you're throwing hooks and uppercuts in a combination, you can get clipped with an elbow, you can get clipped with a whole bunch of stuff. So Imavov's really good at that. Another thing I think he's good at is the pull counter. He pulls right out of the way and then blasts them out of nowhere, which I haven't seen too many fighters in the division be able to do. And I do have to say his head movement, moving out of the way and then exploding and countering on them, is very good. I would say the pull counter is the best. Now, out of all of his skills, what do you think Imavov does that other fighters don't do or can't do?
So first of all, I would say the speed of Nassourdine is main strength. I mean, it's so fast. Like he's not a big fighter for the division. He's not like a weight bully. He's pretty light for the division, but he's so fast that it's very hard for people to be, to track the way he moves. He moves very, very, very fast. So first of all, he's very fast. Second, has a very good how do you call it in English? He has a very good perception of the strikes coming. So he's very good at feeling like the strikes coming here, coming here, coming here. Very good at that. And third, I would say is maybe the most or one of the most well-rounded fighter in the division, like especially at the top of the division. I wouldn't say, you know, if you look at Strickland, DDP, or Adesanya, or even Khamzat Chimaev, is probably the only guy that can go toe-to-toe with the main strengths of any fighter in the top four of the division. Can go toe-to-toe with the strengths of the fighters. You know, like, Roman Dolidze is one of the most dangerous guy on the ground. Brendan Allen is one of the most dangerous guy on the ground, but he went to the ground with them. He went to the ground and was pretty close to submit them. When he was fighting Cannonier, Cannonier is probably one of the best striker in the division, but he knocked him out. So Nasruddin has the capability to go toe-to-toe with the strengths of his opponent. And I think it's something that's very rare in the division.
And another thing to add to that, with the Dolidze fight, when Dolidze has side control or he has good jiu-jitsu positions, we saw with Jack Hermanson, who's a good wrestler, when Dolidze, he wrapped him up and he just
scary stuff, man.
Yeah, crazy.
Scary, right?
So when Imavov chose to play in the half guard and the side control with Dolidze, personally, I didn't even know that he had the skills there. You know what I mean?
I was scared. I was scared because I got nightmare from this sequence from Dolidze against Emerson. I was like, man, this sequence, yeah, like it's like you can, yo, Emerson was dominating this fight. And Dolidze is like, it's like a sequence you can't stop. Like, everything's good in the sequence. He goes from a key guard to armbar to the sweep to the compression to, boom, game over. I was scared about this sequence. And I was like, you don't want to go to the ground with this guy. I mean, if he was training, I would say go to the ground with him. I'm not afraid of him. But in fighting, one small mistake can ruin the fight. So I was scared, but I mean, we did a lot of work on Roman Dolidze key guard. We did a lot of work on Brendan Allen rear naked choke, and we progressed a lot during those phases. You know, it's very interesting because during each, so if you look at Dolidze, Cannonier, and Brendan Allen, each one of them has their favorite, like, very strong points. And for each one of them, we made some really good progress on one very specific part of MMA. So each camp was very different from one another, but very interested.
You keep on bringing up the jiu-jitsu. So you fixed the jiu-jitsu with Dolidze, you fixed the jiu-jitsu with Brendan for those specific situations. I saw you working with a French jiu-jitsu player, Freddy Lele Tala, I believe his name is.
Yeah.
So can you tell me about your work with Freddy and what have you guys been doing with Imavov and Freddy?
So when we are going to train, so there is two ways for us to work on the Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. Either we bring guys to the gym, we bring guys to the Venom training camp, or sometimes we go to the MK team, which is our BJJ team in Paris. That's where we are going. Our sensei is Olivier Macolesco. And Olivier is the one who gave us like the brown belt for Nasruddin Imavov, the black belt from me. And when we went there, Freddy is a young up-and-comer. He's a world champion in a blue belt. Nice competing in a purple belt. I think this weekend he won his first tournament at purple belt. I think it was in England. So he's an up-and-comer, very, very good jiu-jitsu player. And yeah, we worked a lot with Freddy. It was most of the time, like 90% of the time, we were starting from a very bad position for Nasruddin Imavov. And the goal for Nasruddin was to work on his defense, starting from very bad position in order to progress and get out of those bad positions.
Let me know with your coaching methodologies, because I love talking to the coaches of every single athlete to ask them specifically what they like doing in the corner. And for you, what is your methodology for cornering your fighters in between the rounds? What are you trying to get out of them? What are you trying to tell them?
So first of all, you have to give an assessment of what happened. So when you come, so first of all, you got to stay as calm as in and relaxed as possible. You know, as whenever you are in a stressful situation, you want to stay the more relaxed you can, because you want to be able to make good and fast decision. I want to employ as few words as I can in order to have the biggest impact as I can. I don't want to use too many words. Every word counts, so I got to be very focused, relaxed, and be able to tell the good message in as few words as I can. So first of all, you got to assess the situation. What happened in the last round? Did you win the round? Was it good? Was it bad? What happened? So first of all, the first sentence. So first of all, we're going to breathe. Once we start to breathe and relax, I'm going to assess the round. So that was a good round, or that was a tough round. You lost the round, but that's not very important because we got two rounds left. No. So assessment of the last round is the first thing. Second, you gotta say what's going to happen next. What happened last? What happened next? Next, that's what we're going to do. We got to be careful of the body lock. For example, with Brendan Allen, you lost the round, but you made the right decision not to give the back, first of all. Then we got two more rounds. You don't want to be furious. You don't want to go for the war and get trapped into another takedown. We have to win the round. We don't have to knock him out. We have to win the round. So that's what we have to do. We don't want to be furious and go for the war and be taken down again. We have to be careful about the takedown. We need to win the round with the jab, with the uppercut, with the anti-wrestling, but you don't want to be furious. Second thing, we are talking about the next step. Third thing, end of the minute, you want to repeat the most important advice. So, for example, it could be don't be furious, or relax, or use your jab, create distance, be careful of the takedown. It could be one simple sentence, but in this sentence, you have to have everything going through. And then what happens sometimes, that's what I did against Brendan Allen. I told Nasruddin, I told, you know, this one got him tired. Because, you know, you want to assess also sometimes, not always, but sometimes you want to assess also the energy requirements of the fight. And sometimes it's good to, because your fighter can be tired. But you have to remember him that it was as tiring, sometimes even more tiring for the opponent to keep him on the ground. So that's what I did with Brendan Allen. I said, you know, got very tired for keeping you on the ground on this round. And then, boom, you start again during the fight.
Before we got on the show, we were texting on Instagram and you said something interesting. You said that you have a vision of performance for your athletes. So can you describe for me, from a martial arts point of view, mobility, strength and conditioning, what is your ideal vision of performance for Nicholas Ott's coaching point of view?
Yeah, first of all, I always try to look at the big picture. So I think the biggest mistake most of the coach can do is focusing on too much details and paying too much attention into those details. What I mean by that is there's always a limiting factor to performance. It can be the nutrition, it can be the lifestyle. Sometimes you have an athlete, he doesn't sleep as much as he need to sleep, or, you know, his life is just crazy outside of the gym. Or sometimes it's the technical aspect, sometimes it's the physical aspect, sometimes it's the mental aspect. You have to find, as a coach, you need to find what is the limiting factor of the athlete. I think one of the biggest mistakes coach can do is always believing that the limiting factor is the technique. I find it rarely being the technique at the highest level. Most of the time, it can be the rhythm, the timing, the discipline. It can be the conditioning. It can be the engagement. It can be the fear of of, you know, missing energy or stuff like that. But it's very rarely just a technique thing at the highest level. So in order to be able to look for the limiting factor, you have to have an understanding of all the factors into the combat sport. You have to understand nutrition. You have to understand strength and conditioning. You have to understand planification. You have to understand technique. You have to understand the mental aspect of it. And once you have a view on all of those aspects of the performance, you can point out and say and guess, because it's you never know. You guess that, okay, I think for this moment in his career, the biggest limiting factor is this thing. And what I mean by limiting factor is the thing where if I change this thing, it has the biggest impact on the performance. So let's say you have an athlete, he's sleeping well. No, let's say he's sleeping bad. He has great technique. He has great nutrition. He's doing all the recovery, like, you know, he's doing to the ice baths, and he's mentally focused, but, you know, he's always injured. You have to take a step back and say, okay, but how many hours do you sleep? How well is the quality of your sleeping? And going through all of his planning, all of his training, you have to be able to point out what's the limiting factor. So in this example, it would be the sleeping side of it. Sometimes it's the nutrition. Sometimes it's the work ethic. Sometimes it's the quantity of training. Sometimes it's the quality of training. Sometimes it's just, you know, the guy is always... So let's say you have a very strong guy like Nassourdine Imavov. He's very good. Better than, you know, 99% of the person in this planet. If he only does MMA sparring on a daily basis, he's never going to progress, because he's never going to be in those difficult sports where he can progress. So if you only do with him like general situation, like MMA training, global MMA training, he's never going to progress. But if you put him into very specific situations, so let's go to a boxing class and we will fight against this boxer. Let's go to a wrestling class and I'm going to bring this very good wrestler, and you're going to have to better yourself in order to progress on the wrestling side. Now you're going to be able to make him progress on very specific parts of the training.
So with that training and with all those methodologies, you learned stuff from MMA Factory, and you also taught other people, and then you learned from others. So the level of French MMA has just gotten better. You know, I had Fernand Lopez on the show, and he was explaining to me how, you know, even the judo scene has taken off in France. So that's also, seeing that there's such a strong judo culture in France, there's also raised the level. So with that being said, seeing that French MMA is relatively new to other industries, what's your opinion on the French MMA scene right now, seeing that you've raised the level and other coaches in France are getting better?
You know, I feel we got so... A couple of years ago when I quit MMA Factory and the Crepes de France, which was like the performance center, performance center for strength and conditioning, I went to the U.S. I was like, you know, I got to see what the best coaches in the U.S., what they are doing. I got to learn from them. I got to see. So I went to Rafael Cordero in California. I went to Eddie Bravo. I went to Gordon Ryan and John Danaher. I went to Henry Cerudo. I went to Phil Daru, which is a strength and conditioning coach. Went to Exos, which is a big performance center preparing for the Combine, NFL Combine. Went to Mayweather Gym, went to the UFC Performance Institute. You know, went to all those places in order for me to look at what the best do in the world. And when I came back to France, I was like, we have so many talents in France in a very, very, very small area. So like the place I train is called the Mamoudi Gym. It's a small, very small private gym in the suburb of Paris. Very small. We often got 3 to 5 world champion on the mat at the same time on the morning. We used to have Charlene Van Snick. She's a judo player. She did third at the World Game and at the Olympics. 2 times European champion. Kenji Grillon, world champion in karate. Elias Mahmoudi, a world champion in Muay Thai and contender for the ONE FC belt. Alexis Barboza, owner of the ONE Championship belt. Youssef and Yassine Bouganem. Delphine Benouesh, second at the World Amateur MMA Championship. And we got all those people on the same mat. And I'm doing the training for them. And so when I want to, you know, when I want to teach like an Araigoshi, which is a judo move, I just got Charlene Van Snick and I can just bring her. And, you know, Charlene, can you help us with that? When I want to teach the in and out, I got a world-class karate champion that can teach us the in and out. When I want to teach, like, I want to teach the Muay Thai clinch, I got Elias Mahmoudi. I got, when I want to teach the elbow, I got Youssef Bouganem to do that. And we all work together to improve. So what we got in France is a wealth of talent everywhere, like so many high-level fighters. What we don't get in France is the trust that Americans have into their skills, into their capacity to perform, the mentality. Americans, they're ready to risk everything in order to succeed. They believe so much in themselves. They believe so much in their culture, in their gym and stuff like that. That's what we don't have as much in France. But in terms of talent, in terms of pool of talent, it's just crazy what we get in France.
And in my opinion, I don't think that we've seen the top of French MMA. I think that's going to take a lot of time until we start seeing a lot of contenders in the rankings. But right now, even the young guys, they're picking up steam and they're picking up steam really quickly. Bucky, I know that you've worked with him. He's a name that I think everybody listening to this podcast right now should go watch his fights and then check his age on Tapology and then fucking lose it that how young he is and what skill level he's performing at. So I want to ask you, Coach, what do you think about that fighter scene that you've worked with him? And do you think that he is the number one prospect of France right now?
Baki is an extremely talented, focused fighter. You know, what impressed me the most with him is his maturity. From the beginning, from the first time I met him in the gym, he was already really, really, really mature. That's something I always tell, you know, when the first time he went to the gym, I didn't know knew his name. So it was like he came to the gym. I was like, what's your name? And he told me Baisangur Shamsudinov, but people call me Baki. I was like, okay, Baki, welcome to the gym. We started training together. And 1 year and a half after, he was like one of the most famous prospects in France. I think 2 years after, he fought against Cédric Doumbé. So huge number of people around him, but he stayed very, very focused, very to the ground. So like, you know, sometimes fighters, when they grow up, they don't want to listen to anyone anymore. They don't perceive how much they can learn from, the experience of old coaches or, other fighters. That's not Baki. He's like willing to learn. And he's here, you know, to asking questions and listening to the answer in order to keep progressing. So he has a lot of maturity, as a physical maturity, but also technical maturity, but also, you know, just maturity to stay calm, stay very to the ground in order to keep progressing and get to his goal, which is, you know, being the best fighter in the world.
Coach, here's an example of a fighter that listens and progresses.
Yeah.
I want to ask you, was there ever a time where you refused to work with somebody because they showed the opposite of that?
Yeah. So, when I was in the MMA factory, I worked with so many people, so many. When I quit it and I started to focus on very few people instead of being working with so many people, what became very important to me was the human side of it. I wanted to work only with people that were where I was very comfortable, spending time with them in the mat and outside the mat, because I knew they were good guys. And since then I try to work only with people where there's this feeling of reciprocity, and there is this very strong bond, because you spend so much time with the fighters you work with. You want it to be a very agreeable, very nice moment. You want to work with good persons in general, and it makes the work way easier when you work with a good person. So yeah, I work only with people with, I need to feel this very you're a good person, and there is a lot of respect between us, and so we can work together and go far with that.
Coach, if you've worked with these high-level guys and these champions, what are the main differences between working with high-level MMA and martial artists and then working with the beginners, lower-level guys?
It's been a long time. I haven't been working with really beginners. I only work with phenomenal fighters, but even into those phenomenal fighters, there's levels. First of all, I would say the capacity to learn technique is very high with the best fighters. They can learn very, very, very quickly, learn and apply those techniques. So first of all, the skills, the capacity to learn is very high. Second, the capacity to select and to adapt themselves. Like very good fighters, they can adapt, they can feel stuff that sometimes even the coach don't feel. Like they can feel like the distance, the punches, they can very quickly adapt during the fight. And it's only a skill that I've seen with the very best in the games. And I would say third, the ability to perform on the fight day. That's something, I always talk about Steven D'Acosta. Steven D'Acosta is a world and Olympic champion in karate. This is a guy that never loses in big finals. Big moments, he cannot lose. He can lose into something that is not big enough for him. Like he can lose in a tournament, like a K1 tournament, which isn't the biggest one. But like you put him in the final of the European, the world of the Olympics, he's never going to lose. And those champions, those big champions, they have the ability not to ever lose when there is time to shine and there is time to show their skills. And that's something very unique to the world's best.
Nicholas, with the high-level champions in the midway point of the fight, that adjustment, I want to ask you more about that. That adjustment that they make in the fight, how do you instill that for your athletes to tell them to look for it in the, the second, the third round, to pick up on stuff to then exploit it? Because you said this is a characteristic of a high-level champion. How do you try and instill that into the athletes? And can you tell me more about that?
Oh, we try to do it together. As a coach, I want to be a high-level coach, which means I have to be able to adapt during the fight too, and to see what are the things I didn't see before the fight. So the way so there is something you cannot reduce as a coach, is the time you spend with your athletes. The more time you spend with your athletes, the more time you spend doing rounds, sparring rounds, and coaching him into practice, the better you will know your athletes, and the better you will know the solutions to each problems. So everything happens during the training camp. If you had a good training camp, everything is about problem and solutions. If you have a good training camp, the problems you're going to face during the fight, you already face them during the training camp. And you already found the solution of those problems during the training camp. So You want during the training camp to face problems in order for them to be resolved by your athletes and by yourself. You want to try different way to solve those problems. You want to isolate the best way to solve the problems. And the way you're going to be coaching during the fight is you found the best way to solve the problems and you're going to cue your athletes the best way to solve the problem because you already identified the best way to solve the problem during the fight camp. That's how it must be working. So, for example, if you look at the fight between Cannonier and Nassourdine Imavov has a very like in-and-out style of fighting, like Soviet boxing style. But there is some moment where when he flexes into the legs, when he's a little bit lower into the legs, he can create more powers and he helps into the counters. That's what he did against Jared Cannonier. And if you look at the cue during the minute of rest, I told him, you know, right now it's the time to get a little bit lower and a little bit more into the ground and use your boxing in order to counter. And that's what happened. So it happens because we did it a lot of different times during the training camp. So we knew it was the right solution, but he knew it was the right solution because you want to, knowing as a coach, you know, sometimes coaches, they're like, it was written in the game plan, but it's not enough. It's not enough to be written in the game plan. You have to execute enough time during the training camp so your fighter realize that this is the best solution. And it takes time and it takes repetition. But if you do it enough, he's going to realize that this solution is the best solution and he has to use this solution. And so, yeah, during the fight, sometimes you have to adapt. For example, Brendan Allen used the body lock. We have to adapt to the body lock. He couldn't use the body lock anymore, so he has to go to the double leg, which was the game plan for at first. And when you adapt, you got to go back then to your first game plan.
Going off to European MMA now, so Polish scene we saw for a very long time was the dominant European scene, and that's where you got your fights. If you were fighting in Europe, you had to go to KSW. Now all these promotions are popping up. You know, you have your Ares and also another one, Octagon. So from your perspective, seeing that you're there, what's the best promotion in Europe right now?
I feel like KSW and Octagon are great promotion. I mean, the spectacle when you get there is crazy. I would say that back in the days, it was for us as a French, it was Cage Warrior because that was the place where most of the people would sign to the UFC from Cage Warrior. So we wanted a lot to go to Cage Warrior, but it was very difficult for us because most of the time the English scene just used us in order to propose themselves to better record. They use the French. Right now, I would say in France, there is very great promotions. Ares is high-level promotion. We got Hexagon 2. We got some promotion like the KOF, the King of Fighters. A very good promotion. They're doing a show like every month or sometimes two times a month. It's not big shows. It's like, 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 people, but it's everywhere in France. Very good quality. I mean, as a coach and as a fighters, we're very well received, well paid. It's not as big as Octagon or KSW, but with KSW and Octagon, it's not as easy to sign to the UFC. So if the goal is to go to the UFC, sometimes it's better to stay in the French scene with Ares or KOF or Hexagon. If the goal is to get well paid in Europe, Octagon and KSW are very good solutions.
I want to talk to you also about the SNC for the sports, seeing that you also specialize in that. So when I was talking to Phil DeRue when he came on the show, we were talking about the strength and conditioning programs and how they're not comprehensive enough for MMA. So when you're a boxer, as you know, you focus on the SNC for force production because that's all you're doing. And then when you're grappling, you know, you're holding your different SNC. And then for jits, you need to do all the leg conditioning. So because of that, you're constantly putting more and more stress on the body and you can't always get a comprehensive system that focuses on every single part of the martial arts game. So I want to ask you, why do you think it's hard to get a good comprehensive SNC program for fight sports, specifically MMA, and how do you do it for your athletes?
So first of all, the biggest mistake that people do with strength and conditioning for combat sport athletes is not knowing enough of the discipline of MMA. So most of the people, they get, you know, their strength and conditioning coach, or they are a coach like MMA coach or MMA athletes. But very few of them are on both sides of the equation. So first of all, you got to understand that your strength and conditioning is the total work and adaptation you got from your training week. So even if you spend like 2 times a week, you spend some time in the strength and conditioning room, your strength and conditioning is the total training you do during the week, not only the 2 times you're working in the gym. You see what I mean? So most of the people, they're like, okay, there is 2 strength and conditioning sessions, so that's what I'm going to do. And this is your strength gain, your endurance game, your speed game. They're only going to be increased during those 2 training sessions. No, that's not true. There is 10 training sessions. And on those 10 training sessions, there is 2 very specific training sessions that you do outside of the MMA gym in the strength and conditioning rooms. But the total adaptation you're going to have from your body is the grappling side, the wrestling side, the striking side, the endurance side, and all this work is going to give some adaptation signal to your body, and you're going to adapt from there. So first of all, you got to take into consideration everything that happened during the week, and not only everything that happened into the training room, which is probably the biggest mistake you can do. Second biggest mistake is a lot of strength and conditioning coaches just try to replicate MMA training into the gym. If MMA, so when you start doing MMA, your strength and conditioning is going to improve without doing anything outside of strength, outside of MMA. You're weak, you don't have any condition, and you start to do MMA, you're going to be stronger because you do a lot of grappling, a lot of wrestling. You're going to be faster because you do a lot of explosive work with the boxing. You're going to be more conditioned because your heart rate is going to be increased every time you work out. And the more you do work on the high heart rate, the more your VO2 max is going to progress and your general condition is going to progress. So at first, your general conditioning is going to progress only doing MMA. Then at one point, you're like, okay, if I want to progress more, I got to go into specific training. If I want to be stronger, just doing wrestling doesn't make me stronger. So because I want to be stronger, I'm going to put some weight into a bar, and I'm going to get stronger with the weight into a bar. But if the only time you get outside of the MMA gym, you replicate the MMA gym, you're losing time because you went outside of the MMA gym to do something else, to put more stress into the body, to put more adaptation into the body. So what you want to do when you are outside of the training gym, outside of the MMA gym, you inside the strength and conditioning room, you want to put some real weight into the body. You want someone to be very stable, be able to produce a lot of force in order for him, when he comes back to MMA training, to have more force than before. And when you get from weak to strong, you're more explosive because power is strength and speed, but speed is very genetic. There is not a lot of room for improvement in speed, especially the physical condition, the physical quality of speed. We'll talk later, if you want to, about the speed, like you got the boxing speed. It's different from the physical quality of speed. Speed is how fast my arm moves. Boxing speed is how much I can anticipate the opponent reaction in order for my arm to be in the straightest way as possible to have the good rhythm and to touch him. So I can be the same speed as someone else, but I can seem way faster because my technique's correct, or I can be faster and seem slower because my timing, my rhythm, my distance, or my elbow is stuck out when I do the jab and I don't have the right technique. So the physical quality is different than the speed that you see during the fight. And so when you want to work on the power side of the equation, you have your big room for improvement in the strength side. It can be a lot stronger. Like most of the combat athletes, when they start strength and conditioning with me, even world class, like Alexi Barboza, ONE FC world champion, when he started with me, it was weak. Kenji Grillon, same thing, he was weak. Delphine Benoist, etc., etc. So many people, they were weak. Yacine Bouganem. But when you start to work on the strength side, everything's become better. The power becomes better. The endurance become better because whenever you are wrestling or doing jiu-jitsu, when you use less of your maximum to wrestle, you use less energy to wrestle. And so because you use less energy, it's not that you have more energy, but every move, we call that in running, we call that running economy. We could call that wrestling economy. Every move you do costs you less than it used to cost you. So let's say you have a deadlift or a squat of 200 kilograms. But when you first started, your deadlift was 80 kilograms. Now, when you try to pick up an opponent from the ground, when you have 200 kilograms of deadlift, it only takes you, like, the opponent is 80 kilograms. It only takes you, you know, it's 50% of your max. But when your max was 80 kilograms, it was your max doing that. So it did cost you a lot of energy back in the days. But not that your max is 200 kilograms. It only costs you 40% of your maximum energy. And so you can do it a lot of time. And endurance is the ability to repeat movement over time. So, because we could talk hours about that, but to be very short on the question, first of all, you got to take into consideration the whole training week of the MMA fighter. And during the whole training week of the MMA fighter, most of the MMA fighters do a lot of conditioning during the training week because fighting by itself is very conditioning oriented task. They do some strength work, but not enough to get very strong. So it's very interesting to do some strength work outside of the room. To do strength work, you got to be stable. You got to put some weight into the bar. Very basic, like multi-joint training, getting stronger. And then the technique side of it, you're going to work it during the MMA time. You don't want to work technical side with your strength and conditioning coach. That's a big mistake I see very often. Like, they try to replicate, like they take two elastic band or whatever, and they try to replicate straight punches with that. First of all, they don't know the technique. Second of all, a punch is something where you release something, like you take a ball and you try to throw the balls the further possible, but it's not something where you release. It's something, it's a ballistic movement. So it's most of the time when strength and conditioning coach try to be MMA trainer, that's a big mistake most of the time. They should focus on your goal as strength and conditioning coach is to transform your athlete into a better athlete. That's your goal. You have a fighter, he's not a great athlete, transform him into a better athlete, and he's going to be a better fighter because of that. You can bring a little bit of conditioning into the training session. You can also separate the conditioning. The way to separate is very traditional. So let's say you have a specific line. Specificity is sparring. Sparring session is a more specific conditioning session you can have. And you have to do as much sparring as you can do. But you cannot do only sparring because that would be too tiring for the fighter. And with the time, it's very dangerous. You can get damage from it. So sparring is the most important, but you can't do only sparring. So you need to have other forms of cardio. So sparring is the most specific. Then you have like pad work. Pad work, you can do pad work with a reaction. So I do pad work, boom. I bring my reaction. I can wrestle with you. I can kick you. I can strike you. So that's the most specific. Then you have like bag work. Bag work is very specific, but less specific than pad work or sparring. Then you have doing like some cardio training on the treadmill or, you know, the rowing machine or whatever. And, you know, most of the people, they try to say, like, you got to run or you got to spar or you got... No, it's not or. I'm going to spar as much as possible. I'm going to create as much specific situation like it can be some drills quick drills, stuff like that. I'm going to create as much as I can. But if there is more need for more energy and more cardio training, and I don't have enough with that, I can add some pad works. I can have some treadmill training, because treadmill is very easy for me to increase, and there is less damage for the body. So, you know, it's just tools, and you got to use the right tools at the right moment.
With the adaptation, when I was striking and doing jits, I was running and I was also lifting weights. Then when I started wrestling, I went ballistic, coach. I got big. I got huge, right? So the wrestling adaptation for me set me on explosion, like an explosive TNT. So I want to ask you, if you're doing all this stuff with your athletes, how do you know when you're pushing your athlete too much? And how do you know to not push them so far that they're going to incur injury?
Yeah. So you're talking about the concept that we call MRV, the maximum recovery volume that you can use. There's some very interesting stuff about that with Mike Israetel, I think is the one who came with the concept of MRV. So basically, there's a maximum amount of volume you can put an athlete through and is still recovering from it. How do you perceive those things? You can have like numbers. So for example, you have the heart rate, resting heart rate at the morning is a very good indication of the rest of the athlete. If the heart rate is moving too much, too fast, it's a very bad sign. It's a sign of a sympathetic activity, which means he's not recovering as much as he should be recovering. So that's the first sign that you can measure. You can measure like the grip strength. Very good indicator of the ability to have the nervous system be ready. You can also track the progress. Like, so let's say last week he squatted 120 kilograms. And this week you can tell that 120 kilograms doesn't move as fast, or it moves as fast, but it cannot take more. It means between last week and this week, he hasn't recovered enough for him to increase the performance. And then you have the eye of the coach. So what is the eye of the coach? When my guy is coming, he has like the attitude that he wants to train. He feels fresh and he wants to train. When he's training, or when he's going to do through the warm-up, is he fast or is he slow? Is he irritable or is he like, easygoing? Does he recover fast between rounds, or does he recover slow? Does he react fast or slow? Does he learn technique fast or slow? And all those elements is like, you cannot quantify them. It's just, you know, experience when you are a coach for a very long time. There's a lot of small things that you get from your athlete, and you also need to talk with the athlete. How do you feel? How do you feel? Do you feel fresh? Do you feel fast? The coach is trying to bring all those information together in order to make judgment and to take decisions. There's no perfect decision. There's the best decision you can take at the moment with the information available and your level of expertise and comprehension of what's happening. Sometimes you do mistakes, and sometimes you just you do the right thing. That's what we're trying to do. Minimize risk. And, you always need also, that's something I learned from Fernando Lopez at the time. Sometimes, you know, maximizing performance is a very dangerous bet that you take against your athlete. Because what's the goal of, you know, being 5 kilograms stronger on the squat versus being the same strength and having a good week of training with your athlete? So we always go back to the big picture and the holistic vision of the performance in order to make the right decision. The biggest mistake that can happen during a training camp is having too many coaches focus only on their field of expertise without having someone like the head coach measuring each one contribution in order to put the athlete at the center of the performance.
That's all we have time for, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you, Nicholas, for coming on the show. Is there any final remarks you want to say to the fans at home as we wrap up the podcast tonight?
Oh, just thanks a lot for the support on the social medias, on the internet, and everything that, nothing's possible with a defense. So thanks a lot.
Follow Nicholas Ott on Instagram, link in the description, and follow Anything Combat. We will see you all next time. Goodbye.
I'm coming for the kill.